Welcome to the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology's Counting the Earth podcast from a cold but sunny riverbank in Reading. I'm Alice Hope.
And I'm Sue Nelson. In this podcast, we look at nature and the environment, but always through the lens of one number. And today's number is soberingly large, 1.14 million, as we're looking at a subject of major global concern, the increase in antimicrobial resistance. And 1.14 million is the number of deaths attributed just to bacterial antimicrobial resistance in 2021. According to the UN Environment Programme, some estimates suggest it could cause up to 10 million deaths by 2050 if the world doesn't get a handle on this problem.
Why have we come to a river to explore this topic? Well, the environment and particularly rivers and polluting inputs like farms and wastewater play a really important role in the spread of microorganisms and their genes that make them resistant to antimicrobials. For example, wastewater acts as a mixing pot for all the microbes that we excrete or clean away and the chemicals we use in our homes and workplaces. They're flushed down our drains and end up in wastewater treatment plants like the Thames Water Works near us here on the outskirts of Reading. And then once they're treated, that wastewater flows back into our rivers, in this case, our old friend, the River Kennet, which I visited as part of our episode on river water quality.
I remember that episode because I was rather envious of you wearing waders and you saw these lovely sort of caddis flies, like aliens, if I remember rightly.
Yes, the caddis fly larvae that live in the river. Unfortunately, I forgot my waders today, so I can't go in and rustle any up on this particular occasion.
Well, today we're a little downstream of where you were then in Marlborough, and shortly we'll be heading inside the sewage works to take a look at what goes on in there. But with us on the riverbank we have Dr. Holly Tipper and Dr. Isabel Stanton, molecular microbiologists from UKCEH. They and their colleagues at UKCEH have been carrying out extensive research into the role of the environment in the proliferation of antimicrobial resistant microbes and how human activity is contributing to the problem. Holly and Isabel, welcome to the podcast. Let's start with you, Holly. I think most people have heard of antibiotic resistance, but what exactly is antimicrobial resistance?
Antibiotic resistance is just a type of antimicrobial resistance. Antimicrobial resistance is the ability of a microorganism to defend itself against treatments with antimicrobials. And these antimicrobials can be antibiotics, antifungals, antivirals. And this is what antibiotic resistance is just a type of that. And these antimicrobials can be used to target different microorganisms as well. So we're thinking bacteria, fungi and viruses.
Now, our headline number is about deaths caused by drug-resistant bacteria, but it's not just bacterial infections that are the problem, is it, Isabel?
Fungi have been historically under-researched, and the research has been chronically underfunded. And it's only very recently that the Centre for Disease Control has highlighted resistant fungi that are problems in the clinic as a real threat to human health.
We referenced in the introduction that the microbes themselves are only part of the equation. There is a catalyst for the development of this drug resistance, and that's all the chemicals and medicines that we excrete or flush down our drains. Isabel, what exactly is their role?
So if we're using chemicals such as antimicrobials in the clinic, we take those and then we may excrete them in their full active form, and these go into wastewater treatment plants and then out into the environment. And these chemicals have the potential to increase the resistance. So if you have a mixture of susceptible and resistant bacteria and they're exposed to antibiotics in the environment, the susceptible bacteria may be killed or their growth rate may be reduced, and this may allow resistant bacteria to increase over time.
Obviously, antibiotics and antivirals that are used in medicine are really important, but thinking about my own sort of cleaning cupboard at home, I've got disinfectants that say they kill 99% of bacteria and viruses. Do they also contribute to this?
Yeah, so chemicals used in the home, such as disinfectants, are also antimicrobials. So those concentrations of those chemicals entering drainage systems will also have an impact on resistance. But also things like antifungal shampoos, so dandruff shampoos, are also entering drains and will be impacting the microorganisms there.
But Holly, what goes into the sewage network isn't the only source, is it?
No, if we're thinking about sources of chemicals and antimicrobial resistant microbes in the environment, we also need to consider runoff from land. So this can be from agricultural land where livestock are kept and treated with antimicrobials, but also antimicrobials are used as crop protection products. So we get runoff from those land use types and also from urban land as well. So we get all the chemicals that come into the drains from roads and urban land.
So in our rivers, we've got this mixed melting pot of all of these different microbial species. So what role does that mixing pot in the environment play in developing the resistance?
Whilst the microbes will also be mixing in the environment, also the chemicals will be mixing in the environment with them. So like I said before, this will potentially increase the resistance genes that the microbes carry. And the resistance genes are able to be passed both as humans pass their genetic material, so from parent to child cells, if you want to phrase it like that. But they can also be passed between distantly related species by a process called horizontal gene transfer. If the microbes are close together, they can pass their resistance genes and spread the resistance through the microbial population.
To my ears, that sounds quite worrying, is it?
Well, I suppose if it's in environmental bacteria that aren't causing any harm, you know, they're not going to cause an infection, so you're never going to need to treat that bacteria with antibiotics, so it won't cause a risk. If they're being passed to pathogens which are then causing an infection, that's when there can be a treatment failure. So it depends which bacteria they're passing them to, really.
Now, UKCH has done a lot of research in rivers and in wastewater treatment works. We're currently upstream of the outflow pipe from the water treatment works. If you took a river sample of somewhere like this, and it doesn't look too bad as a river in terms of clarity of water, it's pretty fast flowing, what levels of resistant microbes would you expect to find?
It's going to be different at each site, and it's going to be determined by what inputs go into that river and where those locations are. But we've done recent research that have actually looked at comparisons of upstream and downstream river sediments following input from wastewater, and we found that the total resistance gene abundance was over 500% higher in downstream sediments than upstream. So those are the kind of numbers we could be working with.
Wow, that's huge. Treated wastewater is releasing a lot of additional resistant microbes into our rivers. Does the water treatment not work then?
Well, actually, we've shown from recent work that we've done on the wastewater treatment process that the process is actually quite efficient at removing total abundance of resistance genes. We found in some cases this is up to 97% removals between influent, so that's what goes into the wastewater treatment works, and effluent, so that's the treated portion of the wastewater. But it doesn't mean that the effluent that is entering the environment then doesn't contain clinically relevant resistance, and it's still orders of magnitude higher than what you would find in natural environments.
I guess that gives us an idea then just of the scale of how much is actually coming into the plant from the sewage network in the first place. So I suppose the best thing to do now is to head on over there and have a look at what goes on to reduce that microbial load. I've never been to a sewage treatment works before. I have absolutely no idea how it works.
Me neither. I've been to an old one in London, but it was a Victorian one, and I suspect this is going to be very different.
Yes, I hope the technology has moved on somewhat since then. I'm fascinated to find out more, but I'm a little bit worried about how much it's going to smell, so we'll see how we get on.
We're inside what looks like a reception for an almost aircraft hangar style building. And did you notice those huge bulbous silver onions on the Reading sewage treatment plant?
Yes, they really did look like silver onions, didn't they? We've walked past a lot of different buildings. It's quite a big site as well. It doesn't smell yet, but we are about to head into the site proper and we'll see what awaits us.
All right, let's go through. I can hear the noise already. Oh yes. Oh, and my nose is a little bit assaulted there by, oh, yes, not exactly fragrant. Waiting for us is Dan Freeman, the lead for Thames Water's Chemical Investigations Programme. Hi, Dan. Are you used to the smell?
Hello. Yes, I am. I've worked in operations for a while, so I'm very used to it. Welcome to our preliminary building where the inlet for Reading sewage treatment is. And I look forward to showing you around.
So in terms of your job, chemical investigations program, what exactly are you looking for?
We are looking at various emerging contaminants in the water and trying to understand how big a problem they are. We're looking at hormones, pesticides, microplastics, as well as antimicrobial resistance.
Dan, to me, this looks like quite a big site. How big is the community that this is serving, and what's the sort of capacity of the site?
It serves about 230,000 people, generally from an urban catchment. It also serves various traders as well, and it receives a maximum of about 1,500 litres per second. To put that into context, that's about two Olympic-sized swimming pools every hour.
And this site is relatively recent compared to a lot of water treatment works, is that right?
Yeah, it's fairly new. It was commissioned in 2004.
And how have things changed since then?
We generally see an increase in populations for most sites. Climate change has an impact as well. We see higher rainfall as well as more unpredictable rainfall. And generally people just use more chemicals in their lives as well. So there's lots of things coming into the works that wouldn't have come in 50 years ago.
Before we go on a brief tour, I think we ought to sort of just look around us, because I said I felt it was like an aircraft hangar before I got in, and it does feel like one, but instead of planes, it's just enormous industrial silver equipment and pipes, rather like where the Terminator went to die.
Yeah, well, it takes a lot of assets to process hundreds of thousands of people's waste. It's an impressive building. I'll be happy to show you around now.
Great. Where's our first port of call?
We'll go to the screens first that take out basically any visible pieces of debris, and then we'll move on to the following stages, which are sediment tanks and aeration lanes.
Great stuff. Well, let's take us to the screens. Well, it's even louder here. What's up here?
Yeah, so these are the screens here.
They almost look like skips, a collection of skips, which are tilted on their sides.
Sure, yeah. No, these are the screens themselves. We have four of them. They have apertures of 6 millimetres, which means they'll screen most of the stuff that's coming into the works. And then the waste is deposited into skips, which is then sent away.
What exactly is it that these screens are trying to filter out?
They'll filter out unflushables, which are not meant to send down the toilet because they can harm the process and cause blockages.
Now, I can think of one for starters. That will be baby wipes.
For sure, yeah. Sanitary products. They'll filter out things like toys, children's toys that are flushed down the toilets, branches, leaves, all kinds of things that you can imagine are sent into the network.
So the only things you want are?
Pee and poo, really.
So it's the three P's, that's what I've heard in the past.
Yeah, and paper, yeah.
Paper, of course, toilet paper, yeah.
Yeah, pee, poo and paper. So that's not what we're here to discuss, of course, but it is still very, very important. But back to our focus and the reason for our visit, antimicrobial resistance. Holly, UKCH has done a fair amount of work sampling for microbes carrying these antimicrobial resistance genes at plants like this. At the start of the raw sewage's journey, where it arrives, what levels of resistance are you finding?
So at the start, we're generally finding higher levels of resistance. So this is more resistant bacteria carrying more resistant genes. But we also find a higher diversity of resistance genes conferring resistance to a more diverse range of antimicrobials, including different antibiotics. We likely find more pathogens at this stage as well.
And you also tested for chemicals. What sort of thing did you find in the wastewater that was coming into the treatment works that's actually causing this increase in antimicrobial resistance?
Well, most of our work has largely looked at the levels of antimicrobials, and these can include antibiotics and also biocides. And we find that you have a large range of these chemicals in the influent that you probably don't see at treatment stages down the line. And we find that these will be coming from people's medications, but also the daily activities that we use them for, such as chemical products in cleaning, and also those from industrial uses as well.
Dan, in your role here at Thames Water, you focus on the chemical contaminants in our water, like Holly just mentioned. You sort of mentioned earlier that people are using more chemicals. What kind of things are ending up down our drains that didn't used to?
There's an amazingly long list of chemicals that finds its way into treatment works. These include pharmaceuticals, even recreational drugs, veterinary products, things like paints and bleach. And of course, the reason we're here today is the antimicrobial compounds as well, such as antibiotics and antifungal compounds.
You touched upon climate change earlier. Obviously, as we know, it's causing more extreme weather events. So we're getting more rainwater washing in into the drains. And I'm assuming then that brings more chemicals and microparticles as well.
Yes, you can get runoff from roads. You can get runoff from agricultural fields as well, from urban areas. This brings in a range of chemicals, including fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides from farms, but also the antimicrobial compounds and microplastics as well. Another chemical to mention are forever chemicals. These are hot topics at the moment, otherwise known as PFAS. They're ubiquitous in the environment, and whenever you get high rainfall events, which are becoming more and more frequent, all of these chemicals end up at the sewage treatment works in high numbers.
And presumably what you get coming into different treatment works will depend a lot on the location, the location of the plant and the population that it serves as well.
There's differences in plants that are based in urban catchments and rural catchments. You'd imagine in rural catchments there's more agricultural products such as pesticides, herbicides, etc. And in urban catchments you'd imagine there's more microplastics, for instance. In the previous chemical investigations programme, they found that sites that serve smaller catchments actually had more antimicrobial resistance. This may be related to the population that's in those catchments.
Are you saying that maybe an older population will tend to use more medicines?
That's probably it, yeah.
So we've seen this first stage of the process. Where does the effluent go next?
The effluent goes to some sediment tanks next, otherwise known as lamellas. These settle out any solids that are not captured in the screens. Following that, it goes to the aeration lanes where it's biologically treated.
And will it smell any sweeter?
It will actually, yeah.
Oh, good. Well, looking forward to it. We've come to a different side of the site. How would you describe it?
This is the secondary treatment. It's a form of biological treatment. It's called an activated sludge plant. It's a tank that's filled with wastewater and microbes, and we aerate that mix, keep it at a nice temperature, and that means the bugs can eat the contaminants in the water.
And by aerate, I'm assuming you mean you add oxygen?
Add oxygen, yeah. And the bugs will eat contaminants such as ammonia, nitrate, sugars and various other chemicals, and that cleans up the water for us.
And these are the microbes that have come in from human waste.
We rely on a complex ecosystem of microbes, which include bacteria, fungi, archaea, hundreds of different microbes in there. And yeah, the majority of them will be seeded naturally from the wastewater.
We've talked a lot today about bad bacteria, but it sounds like not all the bacteria are bad then?
Yeah, they do us a favour. They treat the wastewater for us, and they do it cheaply as well. All we need to do is provide oxygen and warmth to them, and then they do the rest.
Well, let's go up these stairs so we can get a slightly better overview of the tank. Oh, even noisier. Oh, this is a bit scary. There's a grid, and you can see the sludge beneath your feet, roaring away. Big brown river. Explain the top of this here. It just looks like any flat roof of a car park, basically.
Yeah, unfortunately it's covered, so you can't see it. But beneath the cover, there's several lanes that the wastewater flows through. There's different zones within the lanes, so some of them will be aerated, some of them won't be aerated, some of them will be intentionally mixed. And that encourages different populations of bacteria to grow in each zone, which then preferentially remove different contaminants.
Isabel, tackling antimicrobial resistance is a government priority. Last year, they issued the second 5-year National Action Plan on antimicrobial resistance, which has increased the emphasis on the role of wastewater treatment. The new plan recognises that poor waste management and water treatment can lead to the transmission of these drug-resistant microbes from humans and animals and plants into the shared environment. How important, then, is the work that UKCH is doing in monitoring this antimicrobial resistance in the environment?
At UKCH, we look at lots of different types of environments that antimicrobial resistance may be in. We look at wastewater, but we also look at different environments such as compost, farmland, air, river water, so lots of different types of environment. We also work with different industries like the water industry, but also different policymakers. And so being able to link up these different sectors with the different work we're doing means that we can effectively share what we're finding, and hopefully means that if mitigations are needed in different environments to protect human health, we can inform the right people.
Dan, that action plan has a commitment to implement effective wastewater treatment methods to minimise the dissemination of antimicrobial resistance and the chemicals that drive antimicrobial resistance into the environment. So obviously water companies are central to realising that commitment. What is it that your industry is doing to achieve that goal?
Well, we're involved in several research projects, including with yourself, so we hope to improve the understanding of the problem. In order to actually tackle the problem, there's probably two things that the water industry can do directly. One of them is to employ advanced treatment technologies such as ozone, ultraviolet, to basically kill or deactivate the bacteria that have developed resistance. We could also use activated carbon to remove the antimicrobial compounds themselves, which will prevent the resistance from occurring itself. And we can also try to reduce the amount of spills into the environment as well. And hopefully this research will inform our strategy going forward in the future.
We've got one more stop on our tour. Dan, where's that?
That's the final sediment tanks that you can see behind us. So
these are the round ones, because I said this was like a car park on the top. Behind us, it's sort of more what I expected with the tank, because they're circular. You can see the, is that water, sludge, combination of the two, cleaned up?
Yeah, so the purpose of these tanks is to capture any remaining solids from the process, and at this point it will typically be the microbes themselves that are carrying out the treatment in the step that we just talked about.
Right. I must admit, from here, it looks quite clear, like, you know, the surface of a lake.
It's often clear and clean. You're left with clean water at the end of it.
How many of these circular settlement tanks are there, Dan?
There are eight large tanks.
And I didn't expect to see all of them from up here, but it's a really good view. Let's go to the final stage there, where the effluent actually leaves the plant.
Yeah, I'll take you there now.
There's a sign here above some water saying final effluent sample point, so I know this is X marks the spot, effectively, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the last point of our treatment journey. As you can see, we've got clean and clear water, which smells much nicer. The level of nutrients in the water is now a lot lower. Interestingly, the amount of antimicrobial resistance in there will be much lower now as well. Ultimately, this water will now be discharged into a river.
Gosh, and obviously it's been treated. And how long has that process taken from all the places we've been to and the bits in between?
It depends on the site, and it depends on the flow rate as well, because the higher the flow coming into site, the lower the residence time. So the residence time means the amount of time in the process. Typically, it will be maybe 8 to 12 hours.
We know the liquid is going out ultimately into the River Kennet. What has happened to the solids that we had when we started out?
The solids are settled out in the primary settlement stage. They're also settled out in the final settlement stage that we've just seen. All of that sludge ends up in the sludge building. There, the sludge will be treated. It will be sent to the anaerobic digesters, which are the things...
The onions, okay.
Yeah, that you compared to the futuristic onions. Yeah. From that, biogas is generated, which we use to power the site. You're also left with more sludge after that process, and that byproduct is pasteurised, basically. The bacteria are killed off. It's then centrifuged to remove much of the water from it. And then it's spread to land as an agricultural fertiliser. It's not used as a fertiliser for food for human consumption, but it can be used for things like energy crops and for animal feed.
Holly, we're at the end of the line. All the treatments happened. Remind us of the difference between the levels of antimicrobial resistance in the wastewater coming into the plant and now at this point when we're leaving from the outfall pipe.
So we heard from Dan a minute ago that really wastewater is really efficient at reducing the total abundance of AMR that we see.
And that's AMR shorthand for?
Antimicrobial resistance. It's really an efficient process, you know, 90-odd% often, it's dependent on site. But we see that even though we're reducing the levels of AMR by orders of magnitude from influent, that's what goes in, and effluent, that's what comes out, it's still higher in the effluent than it would be in natural environments.
So it's obviously doing an incredibly good job. Does it mean though, Dan, that all harmful bacteria has been removed? I know you've said this water is treated and is ready to go into rivers and that will go into the sea. Still any harmful bacteria?
There will be, yes. There's no requirement to significantly reduce the amount of bacteria in the effluent. Yeah, there'll still be a background level of bacteria in there. Generally, the sites that have UV treatment discharge into bathing waters. There's bathing water regulations which dictate the sites that need that kind of treatment. And those sites need to reduce the amount of E. coli in the effluent by a certain level so that it's safe for swimmers and other recreation. At this stage, it's impractical to install that at every site. It's a very expensive technology. Water companies would have to put up bills even more to do that. So it's about finding the balance.
Of course, we can't ignore the fact that things don't always go to plan. In the event of a big rainstorm that overwhelms capacity, untreated sewage can be released through the overflow system, known as combined sewage overflows. So none of this treatment will have happened to that release. Then sewage with the levels of antimicrobial resistance we discussed at the screening stage will be flushed into the river. Now, logic would tell me that that isn't great for tackling antimicrobial resistance. Isabel, what research has been done to understand how much of an impact these raw sewage releases have on the proliferation of these antimicrobial resistant bacteria and other microbes?
Yeah, so the problem is that there isn't much research on this area at the moment. We don't really know. What we do know is, as Holly mentioned earlier, there's significantly more resistant bacteria in the influent. So if the influent is leaving untreated, you would expect that there would be resistant bacteria entering the environment. However, we don't know the role that dilution has from these rainfall events on diluting the influent and if this would then reduce the bacteria to levels that maybe aren't harmful.
Dan, what is Thames Water doing to try and reduce these overflows?
Thames Water is spending billions of pounds trying to solve these issues. We're upgrading 250 works to increase the capacity of the sites. So that may mean increasing the hydraulic capacity, which ultimately means there'll be less spills, or it may mean improving the effluent quality, which is obviously beneficial for society and the environment. Thames Water are also about to commission the Tideway Tunnel, which is the £4.5 billion project, which will capture 95% of untreated sewage, which historically went into the River Thames, into the estuary. So that will help a great deal. Additionally, Thames Water were the first company to produce an event duration monitoring map, which you can find on their website. So that shows real-time spills occurring and it's available to the public. So that's been viewed, I believe, about 350,000 times. And anyone can go on there and see when a CSO spill is occurring.
Isabel, so far we've been talking about the prevalence of antimicrobial resistant microbes in the environment and the anthropogenic causes, but what about the implications for human health? Our headline figure for this episode is 1.14 million. That is the deaths directly caused by drug-resistant bacterial infections in 2021. What is known about how those microbes make it from the environment into humans and ultimately into healthcare settings?
This area of research is really in its infancy. In 2019, I did a global search of the literature and only found 40 studies that looked at the risk of the environment to human health with regards to antimicrobial resistance. And this was all environments, not just water environments. When we dig down into those studies and other studies that have been published recently, there are actually mixed results. So some studies saying that exposure to the environment increases the risk of having antimicrobial resistance in your gut, such as one that happened in Cornwall looking at surfers' guts, so surfers were found to be more likely to have resistance in their guts. But also one that's been conducted in Ireland more recently found that recreational swimmers are less likely than a control population to have resistance in their gut. We know that human-to-human transmission is going to be the most important transmission route of acquiring resistant bacteria. but we do know that some resistance genes that have spread globally and are clinically important globally do have an environmental origin.
Dan, Thames Water, and in fact the whole of the water industry, is in partnership with UKCEH on this research programme. What do you want to learn from all the sampling that's going on?
Well, we're looking at the prevalence of antimicrobial genes. We're looking at the prevalence of key pathogens. And we're also looking at the prevalence of antimicrobial compounds, such as heavy metals. So it'd be really interesting to see how significant those things are in our treatment works. We're using samples from every water company, so we can see regionally how it changes. Ultimately, we'll see if we can understand how big a problem this is, and that will be used to inform our strategies moving forward.
So that could lead to even better water treatment?
It could lead to better water treatment, it could lead to policy changes. Ultimately, it could mean that we'll have to try to tackle these things at source. It could be that hospitals, pharmaceutical companies and the public all need to play a role as well.
Dan Freeman, Lead of Chemical Investigations here at Thames Water. Thank you very much indeed for showing us around the plant. It's really quite incredible. And also thank you to Dr. Holly Tipper and Dr. Isabel Stanton, molecular microbiologists from UKCEH. Well, that's the end of our tour, Alice. It's been a bit of an eye-opener.
It has. I think, obviously, sewage is something that everyone produces. It's something that affects everyone. But I had absolutely no idea how the process really worked. And yet it's something that's so essential to the everyday running of our lives, really.
Yeah. It also was great to see it, the effluent, and go from sort of really quite a horrible brown colour at one stage to the point where when we were by the final effluent point with the water running, it felt like being beside a canal, didn't it?
Absolutely. And that water is now going to flow into a brook, which ultimately flows into the River Kennet. And that system where we use the rivers to transport our sewage is how the Victorians built the sewer system originally. If we were to start from scratch and build a different system, we probably wouldn't do it that way. But now that we have the infrastructure we have, we can't really uncouple the two. So the emphasis has to be on cleaning up what is ultimately released or washed into our rivers and soils if we're going to reduce the impact of the environment as a breeding ground for these resistant microbes. That onus is not just on the water companies like Thames Water, farmers, industry, the healthcare sector, but it's also on us, the public. The whole of society needs to reduce the amount of these chemicals that we're using to ultimately prevent the proliferation of this antimicrobial resistance.
2 points, really. One is that I now know, when you look at Google Maps, that those great big circles are like the ones standing beside now, which are to do with sewage works and treatments, and I will forever think of that now. But also I was surprised really at the role that the environment played in terms of the proliferation of these antimicrobial resistant microbes.
Yes, and also the thing that surprised me was how much we don't know about the role of the environment in doing so. Isabel mentioned that we don't have that much research in this area.
Yeah, only 40 papers.
Exactly, and thinking about our headline number, 1.14 million deaths directly from antimicrobial resistant bacterial infections, that figure was from a couple of years ago. It's only predicted to go up, so understanding this has never been more important.
Absolutely, and it is a shocking figure. We all thought, and they are, antibiotics are, you know, a modern medical wonder, and we have, I suppose, taken them for granted, and now we're losing them at an alarming rate. The thought that we could go back to the days when we didn't have antibiotics and dying from a sort of minor injury or an infection, it is incredibly worrying and something that society should take more seriously.
It is quite scary, really, and more than ever, it brings us back to the importance of what's called the One Health approach, the recognition that the health of people, animals, plants, and the environment are closely linked and interdependent with each other. And we won't tackle the growing threat of antimicrobial resistance unless we put the One Health approach at the centre of those efforts.
Thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed coming on this tour of the sewage treatment works at Thames Water in Reading, and do join us next time for for another look at nature through numbers.